I'd like to welcome everybody here today, including my good friend, little Mr. Boquist. Glad to see you, buddy. I think we're going to open a work session on HJR 7 first. Description of limb available?
Thank you.
There you are.
Here.
Didn't even see you. Sorry.
Yeah,
open a work session on HJR 7.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and Committee, on HJR 7, the amendment places the election of the Lieutenant Governor at the regular next general election held in 2006. This amendment may have revised fiscal and revenue statements, which not have been issued at this point. This amendment removes the requirement of a special election if passed by electors.
Staff, from my recollection, the $1.3 million fiscal was as a result of a special election.
Correct.
Which would reflect the price of the ballots to be printed. I think the language in the amendments takes out that
correct
emergency clause.
You just haven't received a formal statement.
Representative Lim, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Cates and members of the committee. And I want to thank you that we are hearing this bill and having a work session today. This is the priority bill for me, creating the position of a lieutenant governor. And then this is a referral to the people. So people has to the final decision of the constitutional change, when is the election is going to be, when the vote is going to be. Do you have any idea? Yes, can I ask him to
please
my testimony?
Bobby Lee, Chief of Staff to Representative Lim, Chair Kitts, and members of the committee. After deliberating during the last committee meeting, it was very clear that you did not want a special election for this particular measure. As a result, we worked with the Legislative Council so that the next general election, you will have this measure for the public to vote on. And then during the general election of the same year, then you'll be able to vote for a lieutenant governor, assuming that the ballot measure passes during the primary. Which is, for the record, it is unusual, because during the primary, usually you would elect the top two, if you will. In this case, you'd be voting on a constitutional change, and then during the general election, voting for the number one person to take the position of lieutenant governor. The point of that maneuver was to ensure that the governor's election cycle and the lieutenant governor's election cycle is at the same cycle. Otherwise, you would have to wait until 2010. And so that was the rationale behind that particular proposal.
Great, thank you. Anything further?
Representative March?
Yes, thank you. As I read it, and maybe I'm incorrect here, but it says becomes operative.
Can you specify where you're reading from?
Oh yes, so on the dash one amendments. Let's see. It becomes operative. The certain sections become operative upon publication and returned by the Speaker, House of Representatives. Regular general election held in 2006.
Right.
And let's see. So is it the other bill that we're going to amend to move the election to the primary date, or is it part of this?
Yes, Chair Kitts and members of the committee, the purpose of having the other measure was to enable a special election. But now we are essentially proposing that we will not have a special election based on your deliberation from the last meeting. Therefore, that bill is moot. You don't really need it anymore. So this bill should be able to take care of the concerns that you've raised.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to, you know, I'm supportive of the measure. I just want to make sure we do it right.
Yes.
And I want to make sure that this does capture it in the primary. And I don't see anything about the primary. It all says regular general election, regular general election. Mm-hmm. And just to make sure we got it right, I'd like to have Ledge Council double check on that, if you don't mind. So, or do you read it differently?
Back page.
Right.
Okay. At the next, same date as the next primary election. Okay. Thank you. So that clarifies that issue. So what you would have then is a primary election in which there would be nominations for the office.
Yeah.
No, you wouldn't. So it would be entirely an election in the general election if approved in the primary.
Exactly.
Okay. So wide open.
Thank you. Any of you?
Ms. Gitterdad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lim, did you give any consideration to staggering the term of election for the lieutenant governor versus the governor? I just wanted to know what the rationale was for having the governor and lieutenant governor running at the same time, and only because I wonder if that lent itself to the possibility of running as a team or a ticket, which we haven't had that experience in Oregon, at least in the time I've lived there. Here.
Okay, so far, according to the study, Chair Kitts and Representative Dalto, and as I studied nationwide, there has been no other state that the lieutenant governor having a different time with the governor. So I think it's a prudent lieutenant governor, since the person is going to be the team of the governors. I think it's wise to run at the same time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question's already been answered.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick, we are discussing HJR 7. I appreciate your note that you were going to be late. We are in a work session. You got the dash ones. Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Belto.
I move the dash one amendments to House Joint Resolution 7.
Representative Dalto moves the dash one amendments into HJR 7. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so done.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalto.
You ready for motion?
I'm ready for motion.
I'd like to move that HJR 7 as amended be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Be adopted.
Representative Dalto moves HJR 7 be adopted and sent to the floor with a do adopt recommendations. Any discussion? Any objection? Netta?
Votes aye.
Excused.
Aye.
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 No, just kidding. Chair votes aye. Carried. Motion passes. Representative Lim, I'm assuming you'd like to carry your priority bill.
Do you think we can go on a consent basis?
No.
On a consent, no?
No. I don't think
I'm honored to carry this, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yes. And I want you to know that you're expecting another companion bill.
Yes. Yes. Colleagues, we are receiving the companion bill to this from Representative Berger's General Government Committee. HJR 39 is on your agenda. We will be moving HJR 39 until Tuesday. Representative Dalto's amendments or proposed amendments to HJR 39 were just received back from Legislative Council today, so Senator Decker is aware of that as well. We'll now move on and open a public hearing. Well, I guess we'll open a work session on House Bill 2167. Sign up sheet for 2167.
Dash
2. Go ahead and read the summary.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Committee HB 2167, revised election law related to campaign finance housekeeping. And the dash one amendment includes paragraph 206.159 as a part of chapter 260.035 through .156.
Is that the dash twos?
That is the dash twos.
Sorry. Thanks.
Who we have signed up?
John, you want to come forward and answer any questions that may the committee may have before we vote on this? I know there were some questions last time.
We have dash one.
I'm sorry?
Are there dash one?
No, dash two.
Dash two is no one.
Okay. Yeah. John, if you, I don't want to burden you with going through the entire deliberation of last time, but if you could just briefly, I know that the committee may have a few questions before they take the vote on 2167. We didn't move it last time because the committee wanted more time to digest it. I'm assuming the committee's had enough time since the last time that we heard this bill was February 15th. So with that, I would open up for any. Actually, I'll let John just give a summary of any questions that were raised of last time if you want to do that. And then if the committee has any questions, we'll open it up at that time.
John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's Office. I'd like to introduce somebody probably you already know, Tammy Detweiler, from the Division of Elections staff. Mr. Neal is ill today, so Tammy is filling in for him and can speak to the details on this bill. Instead of going back through that lengthy testimony we went through last time, I thought Tammy could give you a quick summary of what the dash twos do, and then answer any questions you might have about the rest of the bill.
For the record, Tammy Detweiler, Secretary of State's Office, Elections Division. The dash two amendments. There's two different things that they do. The first one changes the deadline for a certificate of limited contributions and expenditures to coincide with the deadline for the first pre-election report. The certificate is filed in lieu of filing the detailed reports and should be filed by the same deadline. This was a drafting oversight a couple of years ago when the first pre-election deadline was pushed back by a week. They didn't change the deadline for the certificate. The second thing that it does is it adds ORS 260-159, which is the requirement for electronic filing of campaign finance reports, to the range of 260-035 to 260-156. The statutory range is referenced in various places throughout Chapter 260 when it's talking about duties and responsibilities of a treasurer or definitions, and 260-159 should really be a part of that range.
Just in summary, this, as you all might recall, this is our what we call our housekeeping bill, which makes minor changes to the CNE sections of our election law to clear up problems just like this that crop up that are mostly technical.
John, I'm looking through here, and I don't see the section where you increase legislators' salaries. Was that not a part of this bill?
That's not our definition of housekeeping, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, it was mine. I apologize. No, I apologize.
I truly do believe you guys should be paid more money.
It happens. Yep. But just because I'm here doesn't mean I'm perfect.
Can I get you out of this, Mr. Chair?
And please. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2167.
Representative March moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 2167. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2167 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative March Allen moves House Bill 2167 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Netta? Votes aye. Excuse.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye. As it passes.
Could we, Mr. Chair, put this on the consent calendar as a housekeeping measure?
No, I'm not going to put on the consent calendar just because that's... I don't have a reason, I guess. But
okay.
I couldn't think of a good one, but I we're getting too many things. The complaints have been from some of the members that too many things are going on the consent calendar and they want to discuss it. So
absolutely.
If I can carry the bill, I'll carry it and explain it. And when nobody asks me a question about it, I'll
help you.
We'll be fine. So at least gets me out of the hot water. But thank you. That's why.
Okay.
So
that's
thank you.
My questions now.
Yeah. Write your questions now. Let the hazing begin. Okay, that's a good search.
Mm. I wouldn't know how to ask.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3021. We're going to skip 3090 until Representative Crummell gets here. And we'll bounce back to 3090 once 3021 is complete. So at this time, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3021. Richard, I'm assuming you're signed up to testify. And that's first. Net.
Annette Newingham from Lane County, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of County Clerks. Very brief testimony.
Annette, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Let's let Cletus read the summary first. I always forget that part.
Absolutely.
Too.
Mr. Chair, Committee, HB 3021 allows ballots to list names of all political parties that have nominated candidate for election. Please note my typographical. Please note, has referral to Committee on State and Federal Affairs.
Thank you.
We take a neutral position on this. Just wanted to, one question that we would have is on the general election, if this would occur, our understanding is that you would have like a candidate name and could easily have Democrat and Republican for the party position on the ballot behind the person's name. And we'd be concerned that that would be confusing to the citizens. And we would receive quite a few calls asking, thinking we made mistakes. So that's just something for consideration more than anything else. And that's pretty much all I have.
Okay. Well, we'll let the author of the bill maybe address that when he comes up. And if there's further questions that are sparked as a result of it,
thank you.
Feel free to come back up. Thank you. Richard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to begin just by thanking you all for the supportive comments that you've given. I think I've talked to each one of you about this bill.
If you could rather start by saying your name, I'd appreciate it.
I would be happy to. Richard Burke, Executive Director, Libertarian Party of Oregon.
Thank you.
I guess I'll go to the Annette's question. And it's true that in an election, a Republican and a person could receive both the Republican and Democratic nominations. In other states where this is done, confusion hasn't been a serious problem. Right now, so-called fusion candidates are allowed in close to 20 states without restriction in about 10 states, including New York, California, South Carolina, South Dakota, Idaho, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. And they have not had any of those kinds of problems. Right now, under Oregon law, there have been candidates who get both the Republican and the Democratic nomination, but current law only allows one party's name to appear. So one might say that any confusion that might be created would be more than balanced out by the fact that current law makes it very difficult for them to even know that a candidate didn't receive both nominations. But this is a bill that gives everyone more options. Political parties have a wider variety of choices as to who they would nominate, and individual candidates have total control, because if, you know, candidate Smith got the nomination of a party that they didn't want to be associated with, they could simply say, no, thank you, and the name of that party would not appear on the ballot. So it's completely up to them.
Richard, if someone were to reject, but I'll just use myself, so I'll somebody else. Let's say Derek Kitch receives the Republican nomination and the Libertarian nomination. And I say, that's okay, I'm Republican, I just want Republican to show.
Right.
Do the Libertarian Party, does the Libertarian Party then at that time have an opportunity to nominate their own candidate?
Under current law, we can hold as many nominating conventions as we like. All the way up until the deadline, I think it's sometime in August. So if we nominated you in May and you said no, we would have several months more under current law to do that. If we are able to hold primaries, it wouldn't apply because only libertarians would be able to file. If you wanted to receive a libertarian endorsement, you would have to stage a write-in campaign, which is how many Republicans and Democrats get the endorsement of another party. So there really is no risk. On lines 9 through 12 on page 2, it says specifically toward the end that if a candidate, the political parties selected by the candidate shall be added opposite the name of the candidate. So candidates have full control or full ability to say no thank you. But if they want it, they've got it.
Richard, is there a number? Is there a limit? I mean, could I get the Constitution Party? Could I get the Pacific Green? Could I get other minor party candidates along with, or is it limited to a certain number?
No, there's not a limit. In fact, New York has had that happen. You may know that they have a very strong liberal party and conservative party and several others, and there have been candidates in New York that are listed with 5 or 6 party endorsements. That's not typical. That's extremely unusual when that happens. But again, if a candidate doesn't want that to happen, they just say, no, thank you.
Okay.
Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Just a question for you. Why don't we allow the minor parties of a certain size, like larger size, like the Libertarian Party, for example, to appear on the primary election in their own section, in their own primary?
Well,
is that a problem?
The current law places an extremely high barrier for the ability to hold primary elections. In fact, one of the other bills you'll be considering shortly addresses that specific problem. We would like to be able to, because there's a guy out in Wheeler County, Buck Leckie, the mayor of Spray, served his community for years. He's one of our members. He's too frail to travel. He can't make it to our nominate conventions. So it is a problem, but that'll be addressed in another bill.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Richard. Colleagues, there is we are only in public hearing right now, but if I go to a work session, there is a subsequent referral from the State and Federal Affairs Committee on this particular bill. Ooh, a little demotion, huh? Great. Any further questions of Richard?
Great. Are we going to hold a work session, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3021, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 3021. Any discussion? Action. I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
I move House Bill 3021. I guess before the subsequent referral, to the Committee on State and Federal Affairs that do pass recommendations.
Representative Thatcher moves House Bill 3021 to the Committee on State and Federal Affairs with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalto.
What is the purpose for moving this bill to State and Federal Affairs?
That's the purpose of the Speaker.
That referral has been given to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
I'll answer that.
Seeing none. Annette?
Thank you.
Looks aye.
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 Chair votes aye. House Bill 3021, receiving a number of affirmative votes, is referred to the State and Federal Affairs for due pass recommendation. Colleagues, at this time we will revert back to House Bill 3090 and open a public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 3090.
Representative Thatcher, I would love it. I've waited all day for this.
Staff, you want to read the summary on this?
Mr. Chair,
House Bill 3090 provides that ballots rejected by vote tally system may not be counted, prohibits elections officials from modifying ballot cast by elector, directs county clerks to develop security procedures governing counting of ballots, requires that ballots be stored in secure location, prohibits opening of return identification secret envelopes in election conducted by mail until 8:30 a.m. on the date of election, prohibits ballot drop sites established by persons other than election officials, directs county clerks to provide training for persons who watch receiving and counting of votes, specifies that ballot may not be counted as a part of recount unless ballot was counted in the original tally of ballots. Please note, committee, we have dash ones, twos, threes, and fours regarding this bill, and some of the changes between the dashes.
And fives. Right?
And fives?
Five. There's someone.
And fives.
Five.
I've got five.
And dash fives. And the various amendments do overlap in terms of changes they make, so there was not a hand in gross because of the conflict in some of the lines.
Well, in reality, okay, the dash five amendment.
Representative Thatcher, if you could just wait 1 second until your chair gets organized, he would appreciate it.
Okay, that's going to be
organized. He's pretty close to being organized. Where's the sign of the you state your name for the record.
I am Kim Thatcher, representative for District 25, Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And I was just saying that the dash fives were a combination of a portion of the dash threes that were changed from the dash twos and the dash fours, which, yeah, it's just a combination of the two.
The dash fives are dash fours of one paragraph missing.
Yeah. So are the dash threes reflective of the onesies and twosies?
Yes. Well, of two.
Sort of.
Except for one section, section six, where it removes a section. And so the dash three removes the section referring to gathering in section six.
Okay. Well, why don't we take from the dash ones and work our way down to the dash fives?
Well, I think we
Mr. Chair, for the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. If I may jump right in here, Mr. Chair, really I think what it's probably down to is a matter of deciding on the dash fours or the dash fives. The dash fives seem to have most of the language in from the dash fours that have been put in. You'll remember from the meeting the other day that the committee adopted, I believe it was the dash two amendments.
Right.
And so we'll want to supersede those with these amendments the way they've been and whichever one is adopted. Let me just point one thing out. And I know that Legislative Counsel Ted Rittlinger is on his way down here. When we had talked with him about the issue of gatherings, which evidently seems to be what causes Representative Green like the most amount of heartburn. But when we talked about gatherings, he had talked about, we talked with him about needing to tighten that language up and making it so that it wouldn't, so that the exception is in place. With the language that's in dash four, it really does that. I believe that in if we take the gathering language out altogether, what's going to happen is that 2 years we will be back here, and we will be back here talking about whether to add the language in, because some group, whether it be young Republicans or young Democrats or old ARP people or you know middle whoever, somebody had a party. Said, hey, bring your ballot and drop it off. And somebody else accused them of having an illegal drop site, and now they're facing some kind of charge based on something else. But by having that exception in there and the way that it's crafted in the dash fours, it really solves that problem. And I think that's really what it comes down to. My very quick look, I mean really quick look at dash fives, it appears to have canvas of vote issues. It appears to have everything else. It's that gathering language that I think is really the issue.
Yeah, if I may comment, Mr. Chair, it's if you look at the dash fours, what's missing in the dash five is the on page 2, line 13, the sentence that begins with this subsection. It deletes that and the next three lines.
other than that, the intention is to have exactly the same as the dash.
Should we address the other parts of the dash 4 that are changed from the dash 2?
Oh, sure.
We haven't talked about those. There were some concerns raised during the last meeting about this, last hearing, from the county clerks, especially when it relates to section, which section is that? Section 7. I'm losing my spot here. Section 6, starting with, look on the top of page 3, where we're referring to a minimum number of places of deposit that need to be maintained for a certain size electorate. Well, they had concern that if just one city in the county was having an election, they didn't want to have to maintain a place of deposit all over the county. So we changed the language somewhat to reflect that it just includes the number of electors eligible to vote in a particular election. And so it would just count, rather than countywide, it would just count per district that's up, you know, when there's an issue up for an election. So that was changed on page 3. And then there was an issue raised by the League of Women Voters when it starts on bottom of page 3, subsection 3, section 8, relating to people who are the observers. And it just clarifies that in order to be an observer, you are going to be receiving training, and it just clarifies that training gets scheduled prior to an election, and a person is not required to receive training more than once a year. Like, say if there's 3 or 4 elections in 1 year, they would not have to be trained each and every time. And then going down to subsection 3 of section 9, it just clarifies another issue brought up during the hearing that does allow that when you do find some extra ballots that, and there's a recount, whatever, this provides an avenue for those to be counted, but takes it out of the purview of the county clerk, which I think relieves them quite a bit, so they aren't accused of whatever political maneuvering that they may have been accused in the past. And it takes it out of their purview, puts it in the court. They can contest the election based on whatever the reasons are that they present to them, and it's out of their hands at that point. So that just clarifies that on page 4. Did I miss anything? You want to talk about that one?
Yes, I'm going to attempt to talk a little bit about section 11, Mr. Chair, of the dash fours. And you'll notice that Legislative Council is now sitting beside me, which is good because he can explain this as well as the gathering issue quite probably better than I can. But what this is doing is making sure that the court would understand that in the case of a person that's been nominated, and if there's been a mistake that's being recognized, that the there's a mechanism for fixing it. And so, without digging my hole any deeper, Mr. Chair, I would like to ask, if it's all right with you, ask Ted Ruttlinger from Legislative Council to help me to bail me out here.
Ted, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Ted Reutlinger from Legislative Council. That's a fairly accurate description of the amendment in Section 11. It's simply designed to clarify the election contest statute to apply in a case where ballots were not counted by mistake, that would be a valid reason for anybody to file a contest of election in circuit court. This amendment is designed to tell the court that if ballots are not counted by mistake, that the court can only overturn the result of the election if the total number of ballots that were not counted, if added to the second place finisher's total, would exceed the number of votes that the winner got. In other words, if there weren't enough ballots, if somebody won by 1,000 votes and the county clerk failed to count 800 votes by mistake, obviously there's no way, even if all of those 800 votes went to the second place finisher, that that person could win the election. So the court wouldn't be able to overturn the result in that case. That's all that this amendment is intended to clarify, and it's intended to apply only in the case where there's been a mistake in the canvas of the votes.
Mr. Chair, if it would be all right, I'd also like to ask Ted if he would talk a little bit about the gatherings this year, as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair, again, what the language in the Dash 4 amendments with respect to the gathering does is just create an exemption for gatherings where people might be collecting ballots. It sets two specific limits on that. First, it has to be a gathering where you haven't already set up a drop site for people to come and put their ballots in. Second, the collection of ballots has to be incidental to the purpose of the gathering. In other words, you couldn't advertise your gathering as come deposit your ballots at our gathering set for that purpose. That would be illegal. That would be a drop site under this particular bill. But this is designed to cover our informal situations where people are getting together. They happen to have their ballots. They can deposit them. That's not illegal. The bill is more intended to design to address drop site situations where people have set up specific sites for the express purpose of collecting ballots. This gathering language is simply intended to carve out a small exception to that rule.
Representative March?
Thank you. And kind of a follow-up adjunct to that, would this prohibit, say, my volunteers going out on the election day to people who have called my office to pick up ballots? Is there anything in here that would prohibit that kind of a thing from occurring?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, I don't think so, because this bill prohibits the establishment of places of deposit for ballots. If you are out collecting ballots individually, this does not prohibit that.
Can I ask a question? This gathering thing bothers me very much. And let's say that we have a regular union meeting every once a month. Would this stop me from having a big box that says unofficial ballot box? Bring your ballots to the union meeting and drop them off here without any regard to what happens to them after that? Would that be allowed here? And if the union met once a week, would it be authorized to pull out that box once a week through the 5 weeks of election with my unofficial ballot gathering box at that union meeting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think under this language that would probably be allowed, because the collection of ballots would be incidental to the general purpose of the regularly scheduled meeting. Secondly, it's not a place where you have established a place for the deposit of ballots that members of the general public can come in and put their ballots in the box for delivery to the county clerk.
Oh, does it say that?
What it says is that it doesn't prohibit the collection of ballots at a gathering at which a place of deposit for ballots is not otherwise provided. And that language is intended to apply to the general establishment of a place of deposit that members of the public could come and place their ballots.
Representative Greenlee, is it your desire to prohibit such actions? I think the chair would be open to a conceptual amendment.
No, it isn't exceptional. That's what Amendment 5 does exactly that. Amendment 5, the Dash 5 amendments are exactly this measure with the 3.5 lines about gathering places taken out. I think without the security, we talk about you can't have an unofficial place, you can have an official ballot, there has to be security, that people have to be deputized. We talk about all those things, and yet then we open up the opportunity for gatherings all over the place with unofficial ballot sites that don't say anything about the security of those ballots or anything else. I think the idea we're talking about here makes sense. I think we should have official ballot sites, and they should be secure. People there should be trained, and I think that the notion of having this, I don't think it's a tiny loophole. I think you can drive a Mack truck through it, and it's enough to for me to be a no vote on the bill. I mean, it seems to me we need, I agree with Representative Thatcher and Representative Crummell, we need to have security for the way our ballots are treated. And I think the gathering thing is a terrible exemption for that.
Well, Representative Greenleg, Mr. Chair, what we did want to avoid is maybe, perhaps essentially what would be referred to as a counterfeit official drop site that isn't really official drop site, but it has all appearances of being an official drop site. When you have a union meeting, that's, to me, pretty apparent that it's not an official drop site. It's your union gathering ballots. That's pretty clear. When you have somebody sitting out on campus with their box, that looks like an official drop site. Just sitting out on campus in your community college, that looks like an official drop site for the public to be attracted to drop off their ballots, thinking that this is an official drop site. I think it's misleading in those situations. I believe when you have these gatherings, it's fairly evident that it is not an official drop site.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's take the community college. Any class is a gathering, right? So we could be announcing that we have an unofficial drop site at every class in, on the Rock Creek campus of Portland Community College, and we could have somebody wadding around at those gatherings getting student ballots put into them. I mean, that's a gathering under this definition. Ballots incidental, but it, it seems to me it's the sort of thing we don't want to have happen.
Mr. Chair, if I might, first of all, if they are setting up an unofficial drop site, they're in they would be in violation whether the gathering language is there or not. Because if you look back in the, and we're not removing from the bill the part of it that the part of the bill that removes the language altogether about the unofficial drop sites. So for if you look at the original printed bill on page 4, line 4, it says, right now, in current statute, it says, no person except an elections official in performance of duties in an election conducted by mail shall establish a location to collect that collect ballots voted by electors unless the person prominently displays at the location a sign stating not an official ballot drop site. Yeah, we are taking that language out. So, in, and then we are adding to make it a criminal offense to set up a an unofficial drop site. So, if you had somebody now, I suppose you're right. A person could go from class to class with their box and say, you know, feel free to give me your ballot if you want to. And again, if that happens, people get what they deserve. If they're stupid enough to give their ballot to somebody that they don't know, or to deposit it in an unofficial place. I wouldn't go to a union meeting and drop my ballot off. I wouldn't go to a Republican function and drop my ballot off. I wouldn't go to any function and drop my ballot off. I'm going to make sure that I put it in where it belongs. But not everybody necessarily thinks like I do, or represented like you do. But you know, from a standpoint of, you know, this gatherings issue, I do believe that what's going to happen is that the young Republicans and the young Democrats and other groups that want to get together for this purpose are going to be back in 2 years saying, gee, we really ought to put this exception in. But quite frankly, Mr. Chair, if it's the wish of the committee to move this bill along to adopt the dash five at this point, I'm not going, as long, because it does, as long as we have the clerk's issues taken care of, which it appears as though we do in the dash five. Now, I haven't studied them like I've studied the threes and the fours, but we've addressed those issues. We've addressed the issue of ballot security. I think that's a huge issue, and we've addressed the issue of recounts and what can trigger a recount, and we have also let it be known that there is not to be any tampering with a ballot, that it has to, that those issues have to be decided. So from the standpoint of most of the goals of which I'm trying to get at, and hopefully the goals that Representative Thatcher is trying to get at, and represent Flores with sponsoring this bill are primarily met.
Mr. Chair, can I just with the greatest possible respect, Representative Carmel, I take exception to the characterization of somebody giving their ballot to somebody that they don't know is stupid. I myself have collected plenty of ballots along the campaign trail in those last days when people can't get out of the house or can't get their ballots in for some reason, and people choose to vote the way they want to. And as long as they get their ballot in by 8 o'clock to an elections office, that's acceptable. It's fine. And I've heard you use that term more than once, and I ask you to maybe reconsider that term. Because it bothers me. Yeah. Mr. Chair, there are a lot of issues on this bill. I'm not sure that we're sort of prepared to move this forward at this time. I don't know if you need a motion, but I'd like to take the weekend to review these amendments and bring this bill up for consideration on Tuesday if we can. If you need a motion to do a date certain, that's fine. But
I mean, we're going to stand at ease for 6 minutes. I'd like to see you three in my office.
It seems to me like we've got some concerns resolved. So
one's resolved, others arise. When you get to the bottom, you go back to the top.
Ted, the difference between the fours and the fives, I understand, as was brought up outside, the enforcement issue, quite simply. Can you speak to that, or we may need the Secretary of State's office since they oversee that whole process. What legally speak to me, if you would.
Mr. Chair, again, Ted Reutlinger from the Legislative Council's office. Section 6, subsection 1, that prohibits the establishment of a place of deposit by somebody who's not an elections official, it seems could raise enforcement issues, in both cases. But if you don't have any kind of exception for gatherings, it seems to me that you're going to have a question in cases where people in their homes have invited people over to collect ballots, to have a party. Nowhere in the statutes is there a specific definition of what constitutes a place of deposit for ballots, a ballot drop site, to use the other term. So in either case, I think, if you have this exception for gatherings or not, you're still going to have enforcement issues that arise on a case-by-case basis to determine whether or not something is, in fact, a ballot drop site, or if you have the exception in addition, whether or not it's a gathering that fits into the exemption. So in either case, the Secretary of State's office, who is charged with enforcing the election laws, if they receive a complaint about this section, would have to determine whether or not the specific facts of the case fit within the prohibition or the exception.
Ted, I am assuming, just from my extensive experience with you, that you wrote both 4 and 5.
I did.
Is it your opinion that anyone is more, I guess, legally thorough, that gets at the totality of what's trying to be obtained in the language here?
Mr. Chair, that's really a question I can't answer.
I figure you would, but I figured I'd ask it anyway.
I believe that the committee is faced with a policy decision here and not a legal decision.
Maybe I could ask John Limbach to come forward and put him on the spot if that's...
And I had a question on the way. He's coming. Mm-hmm. Hey, is there a definition of gathering somewhere in statute? Is gathering a term of art?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, no, there is not. There is, however, in the election laws in Chapter 260, there is a reference to a gathering. It's in the statute that prohibits candidates from giving people things of value. I believe the undue influence statute, and there's an exception in there that says that it's okay for candidates to give refreshments, donuts, beverages, etc., that are incidental to a gathering in support of or in opposition to a candidate or a measure. That also, that, and that exemption is discussed in the campaign finance manual and explains that at some point there's a line that you cross if you are inducing people to come to your benefit by providing a great meal, and clearly that's illegal because you're giving something of value. So I don't know if it's fair to say that the Secretary of State's office has the experience enforcing a law that has the word gathering in it, but nonetheless that provision is in the statute now.
John, could you speak to the difference, if you will, between the Dash 4 and the Dash 5 amendments and the enforcement ability from the Secretary of State's office?
John Limbach, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. If I could preface my comments on that by just commenting that I think the work that's been done on this bill from the time it's been introduced to now is really very, very good. Every time I look at this bill, it seems to get tighter and better. And with regards to the issue of gathering and in general with elections law, I agree with Ted. We have a lot of election law, frankly, where there are not bright lines. And as people who are in charge of the enforcement of this stuff, bright lines, we like that. We would always encourage you to make the line as bright as possible on what is a gathering and what is not. We have lots of laws where the lines aren't so bright, and we just do the best we can. And it often means that someone will file a complaint with our office, such as if we got a complaint about this, and we would have to go back and reconstruct exactly what happened. And it's often difficult to do that. And then where there isn't a bright line, it's often difficult to make a determination on whether or not there truly was a violation of election law. So,
John, from your perspective, and I'm going to put you on the spot, does either one of these, from your perspective, because I'm not the enforcer, I wouldn't have to enforce this, it's not my job, does either one of these create a brighter line, if you will, for the Secretary of State's office than the other, or would you say that both are not so bright, both are bright enough? What would, you know, from an enforcement policy, from the agency that would have to enforce the policy this committee moves forward with, which one's the brighter line?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure I could instantly answer that here without sitting
you are doing
and looking at it in great detail. I think, you know, if you really wanted to cast a bright line on this, you'd just say no unofficial drop sites.
That's what it's
just none. That would be a bright line. To the extent that you open the door to unofficial drop sites through gathering from door to door to door, or as long as it's incidental to the meeting, it does remind me of that law Ted just brought up about refreshments at a political gathering, where they're supposed to be only be served if they're incidental to what you're doing, or you could like have coffee but not a hot dog and all that kind of stuff. And the enforcement of that really does sort of drive us nuts. But we understand that sometimes it's difficult as on a policy basis to make that decision, and so if you give us something where the line isn't so bright, we'll do the best we can with it. But I would say that in either the Dash 4 or the Dash 5 is the line really bright, so that enforcement would be easy.
Could I ask about that?
Please.
I don't see how the line could be any brighter than the Dash 5 that says In an election conducted by mail, a person accepting elections official performance duties may not establish a place of deposit for ballots. How could it be any clearer than that?
I'm sorry, Representative Greelich, I would agree with you. I'm sorry, I mischaracterized dash five.
I mean, that's absolutely right. It says no place of deposit, no place of deposits may be established. I mean, it may not be right, but it's certainly clear.
Yeah.
Pretty bright then.
Yeah, I mean, it says you can't do it. Not on a train, not in a plane.
Jesus. Thank you, John. I appreciate you coming forward with that. Thank you, Ted. Colleagues, at this time, the chair would entertain a motion to amend House Bill 3090 with the dash five amendments.
Mr. Chair, I would move that.
Representative Dalton has a motion.
Yeah, I have a motion, Mr. Chair.
He has it in writing.
I move House Bill 3090. No, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Paul.
Can you take out dash two first?
The motion.
Are you ready, Mr. Chair?
I am ready, Mr. Dalton.
I move House Bill 3090 be amended with the dash five amendments, and that the amendment supersedes prior amendments to this bill.
Representative Dalton moves that House Bill 3090 be amended with the dash five amendments, and that the amendments supersede prior amendments to this bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Anetta?
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye. House Bill 3090.
That's the amendment.
Yeah, the amendments pass. That's what I meant.
Can I move the bill now?
Now, if you'd like to move the bill, you feel free.
I move House Bill 3090 as amended with the dash five amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Now that House Bill 3090 has been amended, and we have clearly stated that it's been amended, Representative Greenleaf would like to move the amended bill of 3090 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, as I was going to say. Is there any discussion? Seeing some. Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sometimes it's good to be a contrarian. I think this bill is going a long way to fix the election system that isn't broken. But so I'll be a no on that just to prove that not every bill that comes out of this committee has to come out on a unanimous vote.
Thank you, Representative March, and it's my understanding there are several bills that are coming through this committee that may not be on a unanimous vote. But
well,
that being said, I appreciate you
starting the process.
So, any other further discussion on House Bill 3090? I would just say that I appreciate the work of Representative Krummel, the staff, Representative Thatcher, the Secretary of State, Ted, as always. You work diligently, and I appreciate you. Anetta, can you please call the roll?
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3090, as amended, receiving the right number of affirmative votes, will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. If we could have co-carriers between Representatives Thatcher and Krummel. Be great. Thank you. Whew. All right. When they say beat a dead horse, I know what they mean. Okay. At this time, we will get. We'll open a public hearing on 3128. Richard.
Mr. Chair, Committee HB 3128 allows minor political party to qualify as major political party if minor political party has existed for 12 consecutive years with same name and maintain number of registered members equal to at least one half of 1% of total number of registered voters in state. Please note, members, that this has a referral to the Committee on State and Federal Affairs.
Richard, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Richard Burke, Executive Director for the Libertarian Party of Oregon. House Bill 3128 makes it practical for well-established minor parties with a significant base of voters to become a major political party. The only real difference between a so-called major and minor party is that major parties nominate their candidates in the vote-by-mail primary election, while minor parties must hold candidate nominating conventions. We need this bill because a number of inequities need to be addressed. In vote-by-mail primary elections, which are funded by the tax dollars of voters belonging to every party, Republicans and Democrats can choose their nominees in the comfort of their homes. In contrast, minor party voters must often travel hundreds of miles, adapt their schedules, and sometimes spend hundreds of dollars to participate in candidate nominating conventions. This creates an effective barrier to participation for many minor party voters who cannot travel, must work, or have family commitments. Under the bill, we would qualify immediately, soon to be followed by the Pacific Green Party. But any party would be able to select its candidates in a primary election if it met the following two standards. One, stability. Stability will be demonstrated if a party continuously maintains minor party status for three presidential election cycles, or 12 years, without changing its name. Name changes are indicators of instability because they often result from an outside takeover or a severe factional rift. Two, significant base of supporters. House Bill 3128 uses an existing standard defined in Oregon Statute 248.008 to determine what constitutes a significant base of supporters. The statute says that any party with a registered voter base of 0.5%, about 10,500 voters, has an established base of support. In many other states, some dominated by Republicans, others dominated by Democrats, minor parties already hold primary elections. They include states like Illinois, Massachusetts, Mississippi, Idaho, Hawaii. I could list them all, but there are a lot of states, 16 alone, where Libertarians can nominate, additional states where Greens and other parties can. But it has never been demonstrated that the ability of smaller parties to hold primaries has negatively impacted the larger parties. There's actually a bonus for both Republicans and Democrats under this bill. With House Bill 3128, small party candidates will be nominated at the same time as those from larger parties. This will make it easier for both Republicans and Democrats to factor third-party candidates in their campaign plans. Under current law, minor parties can nominate candidates as late as August. So this is a situation where what we're looking for is the ability, once we've proven we're stable and we have a base of support, to participate in a primary election process that we're already helping to pay for. I'm thinking particularly of a gentleman named Andrew Leckie, who lives in Fossil, Oregon. He was mayor of Spray. He was a county judge. He helped to form Haven House, which takes care of elderly people who live there. And he is one of our members, and we're very proud to call him one of our members. But he's very elderly now, and he's very frail. And he just has not been able to come to any of our nominating conventions. Others, guy runs a sheep farm in Enterprise, just can't take the time. A lot of folks whose kids are in soccer games just can't make it to candidate nominating conventions. And since we're helping to finance the primary process anyway, we just want to take part two. The current law says we cannot hold a primary until we have registered 5% of all voters, which is about 106,000 voters. Now, this bar has two effects. The first one is it makes it very difficult to get people who do support minor parties to register as a minor party member. They say, well, gee, Rich, you know, I vote for Libertarians in the general election, but I'm registered Republican or Democrat because I want to vote in the primaries. Well, why don't you register Libertarian? We get enough people to do it, and we'll have our own primary. Well, I don't know. You're pretty far away. Why don't you call me when you're there? And so it creates a catch-22. At the same time, you've got people who are not really Republicans and not really Democrats registered in your party who want to manipulate the outcome of primaries because they know who will face the candidate they really support. which is not good either. So the current law creates dysfunction for every party, both major and minor alike. This is good civics, it's good democracy, it's fair, and as I like to say, good bill should pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Are there any questions, Richard, this time? Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burke, you mentioned other political parties that currently don't have this ability, and if we do this, we'll probably add at least one to the current rules, probably your own. Is the 12 consecutive years maybe too high a bar? Should we do 10, or is there... I mean, a more reasonable bar, or should we have any?
Well, Representative March, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we don't have any problem with anyone participating. This isn't the first session where we floated this bill. We floated it in the Senate last time, and we've talked to literally dozens of legislators. We've talked to the staffs of two governors, and the general consensus we have found is that they will support the bill if we have a record of 12 years. I don't have a problem with lowering it to 10 or 8 or whatever, but I think we would lose support if we raise it too high. I think we'd lose other support. Based on just tremendous amounts of research, that is what we have found. We would be the first to qualify, but the Pacific Greens would be behind us, and they would soon qualify. The only reason they wouldn't qualify immediately is because a number of years back, when the Socialists lost statewide ballot status, they came into the Pacific Party, and that resulted in a name change. It changed to the Pacific Green Party. You know, likewise, the Independent Initiative Party, which was the party that formed to put Perot on the ballot the first time, changed its name to the Reform Party when they had a factional rift and back and forth. So this is a product of my 15 years working in minor parties and also talking with many, many legislators to try and come up with something that... you know, it's funny. Years ago, we had a standard where you could be a major party if you got 15% in a statewide election. And Perot did it. And for 4 years, the Reform Party had major party status. But it was a facade. What you had was a charismatic person who could get a lot of votes. But there was no party behind it, you see. So that wasn't a very good standard. And the standard that we have now is so high that it actually discourages people from going there. It creates the catch-22 I described. So this way, you've got an existing standard that is achievable to show that you have a base of support, and you have a way to show that you are stable over time. And many legislators have said that they would like some standard to balance, you know, access versus the fact that it does cost a few bucks to have a primary. And so this seems to be, you know, kind of averaging out everybody that I've spoken with, this seems to be what makes most people happy. And I think it is very fair.
Thanks. Thank you.
Did that answer your question?
more than I would have wished.
All righty. Are there any other questions?
Yeah, I do have a brief question. Is there a fiscal?
I don't think. Is there a fiscal?
We shall know revenue or fiscal impact.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. At this time, I'll call for Annette Newingham.
Dun, dun, dun. Annette Newingham from Lane County Elections, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of County Clerks. I believe there would be a fiscal impact to this. The fact is that currently for a primary election, we, the Association of County Clerks, the different 36 counties, has to produce a ballot unique for the Republican Party, one for the, well, for the major parties, which currently are the Republican and the Democratic parties, and then the nonpartisans. Plus, the Democrats and the Republicans, any major party can open up their ballot nominating to the nonpartisans, and which would create another ballot style as well. So we have a minimum of three ballot styles that we have to create for the different parties, with possibilities of as high as five right now. If this lowers the bar, you might say, to enable minor parties to be qualified as major parties, you would have another set. So we would have to prepare another set of like right now we do green for the Democrats and gold for the Republicans. We'll have, I don't know, purple or blue. But there would be a fiscal impact because that increases it for every ballot style you have on the ballot, which at a primary election, Lane County had about 142. So you multiply that by every party combination that you have, and that does add to the cost of the election. I don't know what the fiscal impact is. We would have to poll the clerks to get that, but I believe there would be a significant one, and the counties do pay for that right now.
Are there any questions for Annette? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Which room would that create an unfunded mandate? Does that make sense?
Supposedly there's a, my understanding is there's a companion bill to 3128. Okay. Yeah, I'm assuming that may be the case.
You have to have some money to go with it.
Yeah, and they could probably work that out in state and federal affairs. Or at least that could be brought up. Are there any further questions? I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3128 and open a work session on House Bill 3128. Representative Dalton.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3128 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. State and Federal Affairs with a due pass.
Representative Dalton moves House Bill 3128 to the Committee on State and Federal Affairs with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I would just say that if there is a fiscal, Richard, to this, I would talk to the county clerks about that. So if it gets brought up again, you'll have the answer to that. Seeing none, Annette, call the roll.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye. Committee on State and Federal Affairs will eagerly await 3128. Thanks, Richard. Colleagues, this time we'll open a public hearing on HJR 43. Please read the summary.
Mr. Chair, Committee, HJR 43 proposed an amendment to the Oregon Constitution requiring review by the legislature of all new administrative rules before they can take effect. Refers amendment to voters at next regular election. Please note, members, that this was referred to our committee from general government and that there's a potential companion bill here which has not been cross-referenced at this time. Companion measure is HB 3238.
Staff, do you know why this bill was sent to our committee?
No.
There is no explanation, so we can't.
Right, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, fellow members of my committee. Article 1 of the Constitution of the United States says all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. Article 3, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution says that the powers of the government shall be divided into three separate departments, the legislative, executive, including the administrative, and the judicial. And no person shall charged with official duties under one of these departments shall exercise any of the functions of another, except as in this Constitution expressly provided. The powers delineated to the legislative department for under the Oregon Constitution says that the legislative power of the state, except for the initiative and referendum powers reserved to the people, is vested in a legislative assembly consisting of a Senate and a House of Representatives. And as I talked on briefly last week, we have a little bit of a problem with law being promulgated by another branch of government, which would be the administrative or the executive branch of government. And I think as I'm looking at this, I think a lot of the blame lies here with us, legislature. What I am proposing is that we take back that legislative power that is vested in us, the lawmaking power, and keep it here rather than advocate our responsibility to an executive branch that also is in charge of executing the law. And that's simply what the proposal is here, is to review the rules. Essentially, what it would be doing is calling on the agencies to come up with how, rather than making it policy, maybe suggesting ways of making the laws workable that we come up with, and then we ratify those in this body. That's simply what I'm hoping to do. Even the governor has recognized that there's an overburdensome nature to our current process. In February 2003, the governor signed Executive Order 03-01, which requires state agencies regulating business activities to review their regulations and regulatory processes in order to reduce regulatory burdens. The governor, in implementing this executive order, stated, over time, regulatory processes can become outdated and inflexible. He continued by stating, overlapping regulations and those which are inconsistently applied can result in confusion, waste of time, and duplication of efforts. And I believe that's one of the reasons we are advocating our responsibility as the powers have been vested in this legislative body. And when we further delegate those powers to another branch of government, we are setting up huge problems for the citizens of Oregon. As the administrative rules do carry the full effect of law, and because the lack, there's a certain process we go through here in this body that is open, it's daylight. It's not such an open process necessarily when it gets to the administrative rules. Besides, it shouldn't be in their purview to create policy. All statutes do require interpretation, but the job of a law interpreter in the executive or judicial branch is to look backward to what lawmakers intended rather than looking forward to what would be constituting a good public policy. And that is simply where I want to go with this.
Simply stated, you want the legislature to review every administrative rule for every state agency?
That is currently what they do in Idaho, and I'm open, and that has been a process in place, that actual it's been on their books since 1969. It was challenged recently in, I think, 1999, but it was upheld as constitutional. Only because they don't have a single house that vetoes a rule. It goes through both houses, and they look at it for legislative intent, and they spend the first few weeks of session, and the rules are given to the legislature to affirm or reject based on the intent of the legislation.
So it's a requirement of the legislature.
It is.
Yeah, I am intrigued what you said about the constitutionality. My understanding of the separation of powers is that we could not implement this as a statute, right? I mean, if this wasn't a violation of the Constitution, we could just have this as an act that said that.
Apparently, that's the way it's being interpreted now, and it wasn't an accepted practice to delegate legislative powers to the executive branch essentially until the New Deal, and that's when that came into fashion, I suppose.
75 years ago.
Yes, that otherwise it was not the intention originally, and it was not implemented that way. It was always kept separate. That laws and policy decisions were made by the legislative branch and not the executive branch. They just merely executed the law.
Can I follow?
follow up?
I mean, I guess we could go reread the Federalist Papers, and I'd be happy to do that with you someday when we're out of session. But it seems to me very clear in certain any current interpretation, a legislative rule does not carry the full force of law. Legislative rule, I mean, an administrative rule carries the force of the rule. Only the legislature can make a law. The rule has to do with how it's implemented, isn't it? Not? I mean, we pass a law, and we say DHS create rules to operationalize this law.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Hildebrand. I work for Representative Kim Thatcher. It would be my understanding of the opinions that I received from legislative counsel that, in fact, administrative rules do carry the full effect of law. A lot of the rules and regulations that citizens of Oregon are asked to adhere to are administrative rules. It would be my opinion that most of the situations that arise in the public are administrative rules. So it would be the opinion that I've received that administrative rules do carry the full effect of the law that authorized their promulgation.
Representative March?
That's a key point. Thank you. It's of the law. And do you know of any prohibition to the legislature changing the law or redirecting the agency to change the rules based on the law?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, currently the legislature cannot do that unilaterally, meaning that the House and the Senate could pass a resolution suggesting that an agency could amend a rule, but it wouldn't take the signature of the governor to do away with the rule, amend the rule, repeal a rule.
But we could change the law to narrowly define what we wanted in rule.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would argue that you need the governor's approval to do that, and if the governor wanted to do that, he could do that without our assistance. So, in effect, the House and the Senate cannot do that on their own. It takes the participation of the governor to do that.
We could override his veto. I mean, let's be honest here. If we want to change the law, we can change the law as the legislative body.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. You can override a governor's veto with a two-thirds majority.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matt Wingard. I also work for Representative Thatcher. I think what we're talking about is just a change in the where the onus is placed. Right now, the legislature passes a law, and then the executive branch writes the rules to interpret how that law is going to be implemented. And under the current system, it is then incumbent upon the legislature to remuster a majority rule or a majority vote in order to overrule an interpretation of their own law. What this would do is simply switch that onus and require the executive branch to come back to the legislature for approval of the interpretation that they have written of the legislature's law. And then, therefore, it is now the onus is then now on the executive branch to gain a majority vote for their interpretation of the legislative of the law that the legislature has passed.
Mm-hmm. Briefly.
May I ask you a question? This amends the Constitution. It amends Article 3 of the Constitution, which is the article that defines separation of power. Is that right? I remember correctly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is our understanding.
Could we amend the Constitution, the separation of powers article of the Constitution, to do away with the one of the branches, judiciary, say, or executive? Since this is the article of the Constitution that defines it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, obviously I'm not a constitutional attorney, but I think you'd run into some serious problems trying to do away with one of the three branches of government, if I understand your question correctly.
Except the argument is this doing away with significant powers of one of the three branches.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would argue that this more closely aligns the Constitution with what the founding fathers had originally intended by setting up three branches of government. I would argue that the executive branch has taken upon it itself through the administrative rules process to actually legislate. And that's the key here, is that we're trying to bring back to the legislative process the act of legislation.
If we pass bills that say you should do this and pass rules to implement that, how does that give them the power to take it away from us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the legislature passes a law, and then the executive branch decides what that law means, essentially, and what the rules are going to be. And what you're talking about is certainly an argument of policy. And
I'm not talking about an argument of policy. I'm talking about an argument of constitutional policy.
But what I think we're getting at is that to provide an additional check in the checks and balances, the idea would be to require the executive branch to come back to the legislative branch and say, this is our interpretation of what you wanted, and do you approve of it? Right now, the executive branch really doesn't have that check. Once they're given the law, if they decide through the administrative rules how it's going to be implemented, and you can make the case that they could be taken to court, to the third branch, the judiciary, to contest their interpretation, but there is no automatic mechanism for bringing them back to the legislative branch for approval.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions of this panel, I will let the staff know and everybody else know that we have a subcommittee that's supposed to be in here at 3 o'clock. We are going over right now, since Daryl's sleeping in the back, we don't need to talk to him. Rod, sorry, you're a lobbyist. You're fine. Harlan, Don is not here. We will be bringing this back, but I want to let very briefly people testify that... Harlan, meet me in my office. Is it Phil Schradel and Mark Carson? Shane, you're off the hook, too. Shane, thanks for sitting through the whole committee, though. I appreciate you being here.
Chair Kitts, members of the committee, Philip Schradel, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. Actually, I was going to appear with Ms. Griggs from DAS. I'll be glad to come back, too, and help the committee if you wish.
Are you with an agency, Phil?
I'm with the Department of Justice. I think Shane signed me up, so maybe it didn't get designated as that.
No, it did not. So you are off the hook also.
Okay, unless the chair, there were some questions that came up that I could help with, but I'd be happy to do it at a later time, too.
At a later time would be great, because we are backed up on time, and out of respect for the subcommittee, it's entirely my fault that this committee's gone long. So,
Chairman Kitts, members of the committee, my name is Mark Carson, and I was here last week, tried to cut my testimony as short as I could, and I'll do the same, but I would like to add some new things to it.
When we bring this bill back, we'll hear it first next time.
Interest here is on the administrative rules and the abuse of them through the OLCC. I have the distinction of having the oldest liquor store in the state of Oregon, and I was told in the early 90s that it had more administrative rules written about my store than any other single liquor store. And why was I walking in a different direction? Well, my history goes back a long ways, but not as far back as one of the examples I wanted to give. I brought a picture, and I didn't bring copies. They say a picture's worth 1,000 words. It's of my liquor store with my father working it the year I was born. I have been selling liquor in Oregon for 36 years. Both my father and I were state managers of state liquor stores, and when they started converting them in the mid-70s, I took over the Hollywood liquor store. I was manager of the Powell liquor store. But in 1953, the Liquor Commission created an administrative rule saying that my store could have an electric sign. You know, that seems kind of silly today, and I wasn't around in 53 at the decision-making time, but that seems like a overuse of a law just to say one liquor store can have an electric sign. In the late 70s, myself and five other liquor stores spread throughout the state, one in Tigard, Milwaukee, Pendleton, Medford, my store in Hollywood and Portland and Eugene, we're selling related items, and Chairman Hedlund, Liquor Commission's next door neighbor and best friend, was Roger Meyer, who was lobbyist for the United Grocers. And Roger got together with John Passantini of Platt Pantry Southland Corporation and said that if we were could sell pop and cigarettes and snacks and that, they wanted to sell liquor. And so immediately an administrative rule was written saying that there was a related items list. Now it seems a little bit strange to me that the state of Oregon, the Liquor Commission, requires bars to sell snack items, and they list them, such as chips, nuts, peanuts, popcorn, in off hours of the kitchen. And yet there's an administrative rule written by the Liquor Commission forbidding a liquor store to sell those items as they are not related. Well, how can they be related one way and not the other? It just doesn't make any sense. Anytime they get in trouble, they create administrative rules so you can't follow up. I have had 7 different occasions over the last 36 years with the Liquor Commission. One of them that I'd like to bring up is I showed where the auditing department of the state and the point of sale system of the state were flawed and were causing shortages. We showed 11 points of legal law. My only recourse was to go through the hearings process. The hearings officer, after it was scheduled for 2 hours and lasted over 2.5 months, the hearings officer came back to the commission with a ruling only on the major issue, not the other 10, and it was in my favor, not the liquor commission's. And the chairman and the commissioners sent this hearings officer back to her job to rule on all 11. She did, and she came back before the commission and ruled in my favor on all 11 points of law. Well, what had happened is it means the state and the liquor commission no longer could do an audit, and their point of sale system was corrupt and was not usable. So they overruled her on all 11 points of law. There's no way for us to win. They create their own rules, and we have no recourse. Well, about 5.5 years ago, they violated our contracts. And contract violation is the one easy thing that got me into court. I didn't have to go before the hearings process. And the contract says we had 10-year contracts.
Mark, I'm going to interrupt you just briefly. Everything you're saying, you said at your last testimony,
okay.
It's already on the record. So if there's something new, and I'd love to hear it, but if there's not, then it's already on the record.
Okay. Well, I talked about the point of sale, and that wasn't on last time. And the last issue, and the one that is probably the most disturbing to me, is my best friend of 36 years, Tiny Matthews, who many people here in Salem knew him for all 36 years. He was legislative chair of our association. In the 80s, fathered the bill of what was known as the Widows and Orphans Bill and allowed liquor stores to participate in PERS. We had to do our own contribution, but it put us in there. It was designed that if an agent died or became disabled, his spouse, the agent's spouse and or children, if they had been working in the store and were qualified by other means, automatically got the store. Tiny passed away last August, and his wife, more than qualified, she'd worked in the store for almost 30 years. She was a administrator for the Children's Services for the state of Oregon. She was an administrator for rehabilitation. I'm not sure what the official title was. And yet, see, the Liquor Commission, because of Tiny's effort in Salem, has done everything to make her resign, which she is doing. And he just passed away last August. To give you an example, what the Liquor Commission did is they brought her into the OLCC, had her sit for 4 hours while a district manager read her the manual. Now, this woman is more than intelligent enough to read a manual, a state manual. She wrote state manuals. They have done everything to treat her like a brand new liquor agent. Instead of getting a 10-year contract or assuming Tiny's 10-year contract, the time left on it, they wanted to give her a 6-month temporary. She had to go through reviews. She was required to do things that Tiny had not been required to do. And my attorney talked to her and myself, and the Liquor Commission is interpreting the rules their way. They're not in violation of law. They're just, it's the interpretation of how it is. And that's what the OLCC seems to be their best at. That's why I'm here. And again, with my lawsuit, the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court said they did not have jurisdiction over the liquor stores in Oregon. We were a unique creation of the legislature, and my recourse was with you. And that's one of the primary reasons I'm here, is to say, help me. Help the liquor stores in Oregon. If the liquor stores can't sell related items, why did the Liquor Commission in the last year allow liquor to be sold in grocery stores? They used that argument, you know, I'm using the one back. Let us sell things. And it also, it doesn't make any sense to me and to many of the liquor stores. If I'm receiving a limited compensation on sale of liquor, I would think the state would want me to do whatever possible and legal to increase my revenue, to hire more people, to make the store look better, and thus put more money in the treasury. And yet the Liquor Commission is bent on just the opposite.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate your testimony. I look forward to seeing you back also once we bring this bill back.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Colleagues, at this time we'll be closing a public hearing on HJR 43. Representative March, just 1 second. Just this real quick, which should be on record for him. Is it the same thing?
It's the same thing. That needs to be made sure we have the
so what's the middle? What's the middle?
I'm sure it's and we can bail off that.
Colleagues, I'd entertain a motion to allow for a request of the Speaker to draft as a bill LC 3610. I think you've all received it. There is a provision that I'm going to read to you that will be added on to the bill summary. At the end, it will say, with the additional provision that reciprocal beneficiaries will have the same hospital visitation privileges enjoyed by spouses. So that will be reflected in the bill summary, in the LC summary, when it's a bill. Any objection? Seeing none, so we'll... And you've received a copy of the attached information here for requesting of the Speaker to draft an LC or allow LC to draft an LC. Requesting the committee be given permission, this bill relating to a mutual utility receive this packet as well.
Is that to Speaker Derek Kitts?
That's not to Speaker Derek Kitts.
Oh,
yeah.
To Representative Kitts.
It says the Honorable. You said it was to the Speaker.
Yeah.
His letter
didn't know about the coup.
Is there any objection?
I didn't see that one, but
seeing none.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Committee's adjourned.
It is you. That language you just said.